Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and John O. Bacon, episode 74 for June 20th, 2009. Jeff Shelton of the OSU Open Source Lab. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers all things free, libre, and open source. And today, we actually have open source in the name of the subject. That's how open source this is. Let's start by introducing your hosts. The lovely and talented karaoke wizard himself, sometimes known as Kermit the Frog, sometimes known as Merlin, Mr. Randall Floss Schwartz.
Hey, Holyo.
Hey, ho.
Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the uncanny lovers, the dreamers, and me.
Anyway, yeah, hi, Leo, it's Randall.
And also, a fellow who does a pretty fair impression of a Brit, Mr. John O. Bacon.
Good evening.
Hello. Of the Ubuntu Project, community manager there, and the new book coming out soon.
Yep, in August, with a foreword by one Leo Laporte.
As soon as Leo writes one, there'll be a foreword. Very excited about that.
And maybe a back cover quote by one Randall Schwartz.
Ah, a little log rolling. I like it.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
Good. All right. That'll be fun.
He forgot.
Don't say anything. So today, ducks and beavers on the show. Actually, just the beavers. The ducks,
just the beavers,
another
yes.
time. We're going to talk about Oregon State University's Open Source Lab. What's the genesis of this?
Before we get to that, though, can we talk a little bit about last week's show?
I have another apology to make?
No, absolutely no apologies required this time. I tell you, our show last week with Tim O'Reilly got so much Twitter buzz, blog buzz, and well deserved. I mean, Tim was an amazing speaker. He's the heart of where this is all headed, and really sort of the whole background of why we do this show, Floss Weekly, and all that stuff, because it's really about, you know, having people recognize and being able to share their work and creative work and bring it together and share it in a way that works for everybody.
Yeah. It was a real treat to get him on. And I thank him for coming all the way out to the cottage. And
yes.
All 12
all
miles.
Yeah. That's right. Yes.
But also he was really on and he had some great things to say. We just sat back and listened, really.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah, there really wasn't much anything that John and I had to do in terms of interviewing. We're just kind of sat back and said, yeah, let me just ask my one thing, and I'll let him talk.
Get him started. You start him up, and that's it.
I tell you that the epitome of that, the top point of that, though, is that Matt Assay of CNET actually talked about that show. That's the first time we've been mentioned on CNET.
Really?
Yeah. So there was a whole article on Monday that got published about Tim's thing, including a lot of lengthy quotes from the show.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great.
So Floss Weekly has now made semi-mainstream media, which is even better.
Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah.
Very nice.
Thank
you. Very fun. Very cool. So thank you, Sina. Thank you, Matt Assay, for bringing that in. Matt. So I just wanted to make sure I got that plug in there for Matt. Props back to you.
Well, and if you haven't heard it yet, go back to episode 73 and listen, because Tim had some great things to say.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else we want to talk about before we get our wonderful guest on the line, Jeff on the line?
I think that's all the plugs I want to do. Anything for you, me, John? Oh, no, we did that already. Yes?
Well, he might have something else he wants to mention.
No, I'm all good. Well, actually, I have one tiny, tiny plug, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
So, as you know, I'm somewhat interested in the concept of community, and I'm organizing a community leadership summit, which is the weekend immediately before OSCON in the same venue. It's called the Community Leadership Summit. You can go to communityleadershipsummit.com for all the details. And we've got an amazing list of attendees who are coming along. It's entirely free to come along. And the whole idea is that it's an unconference to discuss about community best practice. How do we allow everybody to build a really strong, vibrant community?
And as we learned 2 weeks ago, when you talk about community, you're not talking about people in your chat room. You're really talking about people, developer community, the participants in the project.
Everything. I mean, the idea of the summit is to be welcoming to everybody, and the whole point of it is that it's completely vendor neutral. So this is not driven by, this is not an Ubuntu summit, it's not a Canonical thing. This is vendor neutral, a place where people can come and talk about building open source communities, how to build, music communities, whether it's a consumer or whether it's kind of a collaborative community, it's all free reign. And the schedule is completely open, so people can go and talk about whatever they like. So if you go to the website, there's more details there, and it's shaping up to be pretty rock and roll.
Excellent. So.
Yeah,
excellent.
That's my plug. Plug over.
Well, let's get Jeff on the line from. Let's find out where are you calling from, Jeff?
I'm currently at my house up in Vancouver, Washington, which is just on the outskirts of Portland.
Ah, you see me waving? You see? Because I'm in Portland too, so it works out pretty well. So, Jeff. You wrote to me to talk about the OSU Open Source Lab. Can you describe a little bit about what it's about?
Well, sure. We're part of the Oregon State University, which is in Corvallis, Oregon, not too far south of Portland. Mm-hmm. And what we do there is provide, a lot of hosting for large open source projects. And we also do some development work. We have some full-time and student developers working on various open source projects. And we also put on an annual conference called GOSCON, which mm-hmm. is Government Open Source Conference. And that's intended to help kind of show the light of open source to people in government and state and local government. That started as an annual conference here in Portland, but this year we're actually planning one in the fall in Washington, D.C., which is going to be more kind of federally oriented.
Well, let's start with the hosting, because it's probably the thing that I know most about the Open Source Lab. Now, would there be any by hosting, you mean you've got racks of machines sitting somewhere that have tons of disks associated with them and attached to high-speed networks and so on. Are there any projects you're hosting that we might be familiar with?
Absolutely. We actually have quite a large data center there in Corvallis. We're connected to the what's called the Nero network in Oregon, which connects us to the internet too and come out of the internet. We have a redundant gigabit connection out from Corvallis to our data center. Mm-hmm. And we actually recently doubled the size of our data center. We've got somewhere around 70 or so racks in there, which you can imagine is pretty large. About three large air conditioning units, couple of big UPS battery backups, and then a large diesel generator out back in case we lose power. So it's definitely a commercial grade kind of setup.
How many terabytes of data do you think you have there? Petabytes.
Oh, I can't even begin to imagine. Maybe I'll just start telling you some of the projects we host.
I'm just looking down the list. I see kernel.org. That's where the Linux kernel development's being done, right?
Yeah, so we host the master mirror for kernel.org. We host, in fact, all of the infrastructure for the Linux Foundation. Mm-hmm. So that now includes things like linux.org and all of their Bugzilla instances, all their wikis, all their websites. We host the drupal.org, so all the websites and development for the Drupal CMS. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. BusyBox, Cacti, CentOS, the list goes on and on. You can check out our website and kind of get a good idea.
Yeah, GNOME
it's pretty
here.
Much the who's who of large open source projects all have at least something hosted with us.
Now, how did you get into that? I mean, how is it that here in my home state of Oregon, we ended up hosting so much open source?
That's a good question. The Open Source Lab started, about 4 or 5 years ago. And how it happened was just due to a large amount of internal use of open source software at OSU kind of led us to think, well, I say us, but I wasn't here at the time, led them to think, how can we give back to these open source communities? And we had recently acquired a bunch of fiber to connect us out to the internet. And so we had kind of a bunch of spare bandwidth. And, open source projects love to use that up, especially like Linux distributions. Mm-hmm. And internally, they were using a lot of Gentoo at the time. for some of the network engineering infrastructure. And so they approached people on the Gentoo project and had a few servers sent out that we could host for them and provide them with the bandwidth and everything. And, you know, word of mouth kind of spread quickly. And before you knew it, there was, you know, a whole pile of servers there in Corvallis. And it's kind of grown and grown since then. The Linux Foundation moved in about a year ago, and we've just been kind of taking on more and more projects.
It seems. So you said earlier on you wowed us with your racks and all this. With the best will in the world. And
shall I be the one to say great rack?
I think it's a legendary rack. It's been spoken across the internet. So, so anyway, onto the serious question. You wowed us with all of this hardware and the bandwidth and all the rest of it that you're running. And you started out just kind of like giving some spare bandwidth away. I mean, you know, I've given some spare bandwidth away to a few small open source projects, but then it didn't scale into hosting the Linux kernel mirror. So how did you? I mean, in a nutshell, how do you cover this? How do you pay for it? I mean, I'm assuming you don't steal the servers and plug them in and hop on someone else's wireless network. I mean, where does the bandwidth get paid for?
Well, so we're entirely funded through donations. We don't receive any funding from OSU itself. Most of our money comes from what we call our OSL Alliance members, which is people like Google, IBM, Real Networks, the Linux Foundation. We recently received a renewal of a large bandwidth donation from a company called TDS Telecom. And they actually donate to us 300 megabits of bandwidth at two separate locations.
Wow.
So a total of 600 megabits of bandwidth.
That's awesome.
And that lets us run remote FTP mirrors out in currently in Chicago and Atlanta. And then we have the third one at OSU, which allows us to kind of send internet to traffic to OSU because that's cheap and fast. And then the commodity internet we send to the remote FTP mirrors. So we're entirely funded by donations of people that kind of see the good stuff we're doing and want us to keep doing it.
So they're fairly hefty donations from people like Google. I mean, what's in it for them? I mean, obviously it's a good thing. It's a great gesture to support the good work that you're doing. But from the perspective of someone who wants to donate, I mean, what do they get out of it essentially? Is it just kind of public goodwill, being shown as supporting the project?
In a way, and you know, I think it's easy to see that companies like Google and IBM get a direct benefit if these large open source projects are successful and have a stable home to live at. And we've given them that. We kind of aim to bridge the gap between, you know, the things like Google Code and SourceForge, where you can get free hosting. And, you know, once projects outgrow those kind of free services, we try to provide some kind of stable home for them and, you know, system administration services should they need it and things like that, and get them on kind of until their project is self-sufficient enough that should they want to, they could go and buy their hosting from some commercial vendor.
Do the systems generally run like one standard distribution of Linux across the board, or do you let people just basically take the bare box and put whatever they want to on it on the various projects?
Yeah, so maybe let me describe the various different hosting that we provide. For some of the projects, we're simply providing them the power and the network and, you know, any smart hand support should we need to change out a hard drive or things like that. For example, the Apache Software Foundation, they have their own system administrators that take care of everything, so we don't need to get involved. But for things like Drupal.org, we actually had two of our student system administrators working really closely with them to kind of design and build up their infrastructure from the ground up, because they just really needed some help with scaling for their community as it was growing faster than anyone would have thought. So we kind of provide a mixture depending on what the project needs. Either we're providing fully managed by us, either a virtual machine or dedicated hardware, all the way to like I said, on the other end of the spectrum, you have people like the Apache Software Foundation who are taking care of their things themselves. And we're just there to make sure things run stably and, you know, install new servers when they ship them out to us and things like that.
Most of what you're doing is byte shipping, right? You're not really running a lot of hosted applications, though.
Well, we do end up running a lot of applications for projects. Lately, we've seen that Track has been very popular for small to mid-sized projects using for a wiki and ticket tracking and ties into their either Git or Subversion. We like to kind of give these projects an opportunity to use whatever tools are best for their situation. So, for example, we're hosting Sugar Labs, and all of their Git repositories, they access them through a tool called Gitorious. And so we've kind of helped walk them through setting that up and keeping that running. So it's a lot, depending on the project that we're hosting, it can be a lot of kind of custom system administration on our part. And we have one full-time system administrator and then a group of about six student system administrators who end up doing all this work.
You must have worked out then, because you are not just shipping bits, you must have worked out a lot of best practices then about scaling other open source applications. Is that information being shared publicly then?
We're getting to that point. For the servers that we manage, everything is under CF Engine control. So that's a kind of centralized configuration management system. Mm-hmm. We support on that Gentoo, Fedora, CentOS. So if someone wants to get a virtual machine from us and they want us to manage it, we'll suggest one of those operating systems. And using CF Engine, it makes it extremely easy to push out changes to a number of servers at the same time and kind of make sure everything is consistent across the board.
Yeah, but I was thinking more of the scaling issues, because I know one of the things that happens when you're just a single box shared by five people on a small project, you can kind of get away with making mistakes with MySQL and PHP and stuff. But once you get big, you've got to start figuring out how to really scale to where you've got a thousand different people hitting it. Is that something that you now must obviously have some experience with, right?
Absolutely. In fact, today in Portland at the Open Source Bridge Conference, our head sysadmin is speaking with one of our past students on how to scale websites and do all the fun caching and stuff that people typically don't think about until, you know, Dig or Slashdot comes along and rips down their site. So we actually have quite a bit of experience with that, and kind of that's one of the great benefits we provide to our hosted projects is, you know, we'll either set it up for them or walk them through kind of these best practices of, you know, maybe you should consider setting up a caching SQuid server, or, hey, you know, we've been looking at your slow query log in MySQL and you could really use some improvement here, which I think is really helpful because, you know, most other hosting companies don't really care. It's, you know, as long as it's running, who cares if it's slow?
So speaking of projects that you host then, what's your minimum criteria for hosting projects? Do they have to be at a certain size already, or can it be any open source project, and what kind of open source?
Yeah, so we'll host any project that has an OSI-approved license. And where we draw the line is, We actually will direct people to things like Google Code or SourceForge if we think they would actually fit in there well and don't really need kind of the extra mile that we usually go. Like I said, we've only got a pretty small staff, so we tend to concentrate on a small amount of rather larger projects than trying to just host anyone that comes along.
So this, I work heavily with the Squeak community, and we're currently paying people now just to simply run a Squeak image somewhere for our wiki. That would be the kind of thing that we could talk to you guys about.
Oh yeah, sure. We're always interested in kind of these new kind of things that come our way. In fact, I know you recently joined the board of the Linux Fund, and I was talking not too long ago with those guys about possibly doing some hosting.
Very good. Very good.
And do you have for projects that need to move over to to your hosting? I mean, do you have, can you help them with the transition? So if somebody's in Launchpad or SourceForge or, you know, Olo or whatever else, can you help them move their data over? Is that something you do?
Yeah, we'll pretty much hold hands as much or as little as we need to, depending on the project. So, yeah, you know, anything from, hey, just send us a dump of your current SVM repository and we'll take it from there. We'll do that. Some projects like to be more involved with the administration. So, you know, as long as they're not breaking everything, we'll kind of be hands off.
Right. And something that I'm really interested in asking you about is the relationship with Oregon State University. So you said that you don't really have much interaction with them, but on the website, it's, you know, it's very clear that this is part of the university. So can you give us an idea of how this works? I mean, are you completely independent from them? Do they, in what way is the relationship laid out?
Sure. Thanks for asking that. I didn't mean to confuse people if I said we were separate from OSU. We're all actually Oregon State University employees. The data center and our offices are all there in Corvallis at OSU. We kind of, like I said, when we started out, it was more kind of external facing. Hey, let's, you know, take in Gentoo Linux and help host them. Since then, we've actually grown enough that we're actually doing more internal outreach to OSU, trying to get people more educated about open source.
Right.
For example, our head sysadmin and I recently completed teaching a CS course on Linux system administration, which is just really exciting. We got over 40 students in that course, which was way more than I expected, and had a lot of fun. And we're also doing some coding projects for various people on campus, especially researchers who want other people to be able to recreate their research see a benefit of actually creating those research tools in open source. So one of the projects we're working on currently is called the Protein Geometry Database, and that's for the biochemistry department. And they have some researchers looking at, you know, various protein structures and analyzing those. And we've helped them create a web app written in Django that uses a MySQL backend to kind of aid them in their research. And they're actually, once the tool is complete, going to release this as an open source tool so that, you know, other researchers around the world can just download it and do the same thing that they're doing, which I think is a great idea. So I think we in that way are kind of a very close link to OSU, and we can provide a lot of strength, not only to the CS department, but to other departments around campus.
It sounds like an incredible playground. Like, it, you know, it sounds like you folks have got the opportunity to host projects and to do some development work and to work with the university. It sounds like a lot of fun to work there.
It is. It was kind of a dream of mine to work here. And when I was previously working at UC Santa Barbara and saw the job posting for the open source lab, I just could not resist and was very excited to come up here and be a part of this. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, are you expecting to scale? I mean, I was just looking through the website and looking at the people who are involved, and it's quite a big team. Are you looking to grow further and bigger?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we're kind of always adding more and more projects that we host. So at some point, we're going to hit the limit of what we can handle with that team. So it just is kind of relies on how many donations we can get rolling in and things of that nature.
Right.
So you're a pretty big setup. Is there any other facilities like this that are even comparable?
You know, there are none that I've really heard of. I know a lot of universities will provide, you know, a few servers to a project or two, and they'll have an FTP mirror. But I don't know of anyone doing anything to this scale and with this size of projects. And especially these well-known projects. Yeah, it's
Oregon.
A really great experience.
Now, you're on Internet 2. Can you describe what Internet 2 is for those of us who aren't familiar with it?
Sure. So I'm far from the expert, but Internet 2 was basically designed as a research network. and it's US-based. There's other similar networks around the world that are actually interconnected to Internet 2. And the idea is just these really fast interconnects between the various universities and research organizations. And it's actually grown to the point now that there's a lot of peering between the Internet 2 network and, you know, what we would call Internet 1 or just regular Internet, so that, you know, typically when you're at a university like OSU and you go to a site like Google, you're actually not leaving Internet 2 because they're going to have some kind of peering going on where it's you're pretty much directly connected to them.
Is this still using normal internet protocols, though? It's still using HTTP and FTP and stuff.
Yeah, same idea as the regular old internet. I think the real push behind it was to actually create a second physical network, using a lot of fiber and whatnot to get these faster connections between the universities for transferring, you know, huge data sets for research and things like that.
So if someone's coming in and is at a university that has Internet 2 connections, then they're going to be getting the open source software that you're hosting much faster then.
Yeah, so we have dual gigabit connections going out on Internet 2. So pretty much if you're anywhere on Internet 2, you're going to get great speeds downloading from our FTP mirror or any of our hosted projects. And typically how Internet 2 works is universities or research institutions pay some annual membership fee to be a part of Internet 2. And then bandwidth that you use on Internet 2 is not actually, I think it's just kind of included with your membership as far as I understand it. So as long as you're downloading something from someone else who's on Internet 2, not only is it going to be fast, but you don't have to pay for all those bits. Not that the students at the universities really think about that, but definitely the sysadmins do.
Two gigabits to Internet 2 is. Do you have any idea what percentage of that's being used all the time?
Yeah, we actually have monitoring going. If you go to our website, there's a neat little map you can pull up, which shows our FTP servers, and those are what pushes the majority of our traffic, and the amount of bandwidth they're pushing at any given moment. Typically, out of Corvallis, we're probably averaging about 300 to 500 megabits a second.
Wow. And
then, like I said, we have those two remote FTP servers, and those are averaging about 250 megabits a second. So quite a bit of downloads and bandwidth.
Do you provide any kind of statistics for the projects that you host in? Like, I'd be fascinated to hear what the kind of the bandwidth stats are for something like the kernel. Do you have any of that available?
I don't think that we make that publicly available. For a lot of our projects, we'll set up like a cacti instance to help monitor their bandwidth. And some of them are using tools like AWStats will run for them, which actually parses through their download logs and can show you how many hits you get a day to your website and that kind of information. But we currently don't kind of aggregate that and make it publicly, but I like the idea.
Yeah. Some people might not, but
well, you know, we're all about openness here. So, right. In our case, I think it'd be cool to brag about those kind of numbers.
Sure,
yeah, definitely.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially since you're really using, you know, facilities that have been donated for the public, the part of the public square, and you might as well have some aggregated statistics that actually mention all that. Yeah. I'd be fascinated to know like how many people downloaded the Linux kernel, even if they didn't, you know, aggregate that data.
That's not that big though. It's going to be some massive download, right?
I'm impressed by large numbers though. I want to see it. It'll be kind of fun.
Well, I wonder how many people are actually downloading the kernel.
I bet not that many. I'm sure that's not.
Yeah,
the
everyone
popular.
Gets it through a distro. I mean,
it's going to be something like Songbird or I don't know, something that's big and popular.
Yeah.
KDE.
Audacity.
Yeah.
Well, because you don't host everything. I understand.
So. Yes.
Yeah. DD.
Only some stuff.
DD.
Yeah.
DD.
Ed. Been Ed.
Yeah.
Ed,
Sed, yes. Awk, and Grep. Those are huge. I know.
Oh, my God.
You guys are a bunch of Linux geeks.
The last time I looked at our FTP stats, I think we were looking at we were pushing around 6 terabytes a day worth of downloads.
That's wow. almost as much as I do. That's great.
So it's, yeah, there's always something to be downloaded.
Yeah.
And we host, you know, some larger things like OpenOffice. We actually host what's called the bouncer instance for OpenOffice. So anytime you go to openoffice.org and you click download, the thing that actually it goes off and selects a mirror for you, that's running at OSU. And
oh, they call that the bouncer. I like that, the bouncer instance.
Yeah, the bouncer is a tool that we actually helped write. And OpenOffice is using it. Mozilla is using it, although they've kind of tweaked it a bit since they moved on from the lab. And we're trying to kind of pull those changes back in together and re-release a new version because it's a pretty useful tool that a lot of projects could use.
And it's the one thing everybody sees.
Yeah. So, yeah, you don't necessarily see it, but when you hit download, it's that thing that's figuring out which mirror to send you to.
Right.
You probably don't need this, but do you run any torrent servers?
We have run a torrent for GNOME. And I think a couple of, for example, Debian, when they launch a release, will sometimes seed some torrents from our site. We don't do it too often, but yeah, we have a couple.
Yeah, because I'm always getting questions from people like, well, where are the legitimate torrents? Is torrent completely 100% illegitimate? I have to hear it from people like you that say, yes, we do have legitimate needs for torrents.
When things like Ubuntu or Fedora push a new release, you can watch our bandwidth graph for our FTP server, and it spikes to over a gigabit. It's just pegged. And so definitely from a FTP mirror standpoint, those torrents are a great thing because it kind of spreads the load around quite a bit more and has more people pushing back the bandwidth than just pulling down.
And especially when you're going to some place like a remote country that's down at the far end of the wire and the tin cans at the far end, you know, they want to have like one copy go across, even though 10 people are apparently trying to download it at once.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it seems like it'd be a great advantage to that.
So it sounds, I mean, obviously it seems like the predominance of what the service that you provide is hosting. It could be very easy for us to derail the conversation and to start suggesting that maybe you're going to become a cloud provider. everyone's talking about the cloud. You know, I called my granddad the other day and he asked how the cloud was.
You're kidding. That's great.
So it's ridiculous. So do we see a orange square sunglasses cloud future for the lab?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think it seems kind of to be a natural progression as we move forward, but there's no concrete plans right now. It'll probably happen when some project comes our way and says, "Hey, we want to dump some cloud servers your way or something like that."
Yeah.
And that's kind of how things get started around here is, "Hey, that sounds like a good idea. Let's try it out."
Like maybe some Zen hosting or something. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, we actually already do quite a bit of hosting with Zen. We find that, you know, kind of mid-sized projects that need maybe a website and a wiki and a track instance fit nicely into a virtual machine. And then we have a number of what we call community database servers. So a server that's running MySQL, kind of beefy server that we can dump a lot of databases on and kind of share those between a number of projects. It works out really well putting their website and whatnot on a virtual machine and then use those nice database servers on the back end.
So can you, how much access do you give them? I mean, so for example, if a open source project came to you and said, you know, we'd like a website and we'd like to kind of maintain our own development platform, could you give them a VM and then allow them to set up their own tracks and run Debian on the server or whatever else?
Yes, we do that for a number of projects. We kind of lean towards managing it ourselves because it's kind of easier for everyone involved. And especially when things blow up, it's much easier for us to fix it if it's our server. And we can kind of track what's going on. So for a lot of things, we'll kind of take the reins and install any needed applications and just kind of give them the admin rights, like to the Drupal site or the track site or whatever it is they're using. But definitely if people are of the type that they like to get in there and set up their own servers, we don't deny them the right to do that.
So is there a single machine that is kernel.org?
We have a few machines for kernel.org. Master.kernel.org recently got upgraded. It's one machine which was donated by HP. I forget the exact model, but it's got a nice disk array hooked up to it, too.
Given that Linus Torvalds now lives in Oregon, has he ever been down to touch the machine that kernel.org is on?
No, he hasn't. You know, we've
sprinkle,
tossed around
sprinkle
the idea.
Penguin pee on it even?
Oh, God.
Ooh.
You know,
it's, thanks, for, thanks for sharing.
Well, haven't you been at that ritual? I think there's a ritual, I believe.
It's more of a way of life than a ritual.
We kind of thought it would be a neat idea to at least get like a cardboard cutout of,
there you go,
of him and set it next to the box. Because actually, master.kernel.org is probably the most photographed machine in our data center.
Oh,
people
neat.
Like want to, you know, reach down and put their finger on it and have the picture taken.
That's so cool.
It's really fun for people to be like, oh, this is kind of where it all comes from.
That's really
people
neat.
Have a,
yeah.
People have a picture taken with the server. Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I would do it in a minute. If I was down there right now, I'd be pointing it. I'd be touching it right now.
Oh, yeah, me too, for sure.
I must be missing out on something here.
Yeah, what's wrong
server.
With you? Don't you get it? Don't you get it, man?
Come it's on. Exciting to people.
Okay.
Hey, back in the day when I was had friends that worked for Hotmail, I actually got to go to the racks where Hotmail was. And I got to touch the Hotmail machine.
Yeah, I can talk that. I saw the first Google racks and the first Yahoo racks. I remember when Yahoo was just in a little tiny tilt up in Silicon Valley, and there was like four servers.
Mm-hmm.
We went in there. Now, see, that's pretty cool. You couldn't touch the Google or Yahoo server anymore. There is not one.
Right. Right.
I think it's neat that there's one kernel server.
Yeah, and then, like I said, we also host the entire infrastructure for the Linux Foundation. So they actually have three full racks of servers. About two of those are for production websites and servers, and the other rack is development for things like the LSB developers who are working on, you know, setting up those standards and making sure things work how they should.
Yeah. And the one laptop per child, that's the sugar stuff, right? Or is that different?
Yeah, so we actually got involved a few years ago with one laptop per child. We had a couple of students who were really interested in it. And emailed the developers and said, hey, how can we get involved? What can we do to help? And got a quick reply back that, hey, we need a word processor, but we need it in like 2 days. Can you do that? And so these guys stayed up all night and ended up porting Abby Word over to the OLPC platform, the Sugar platform.
That's neat.
And that was a kind of a great experience for them and got them a lot of recognition at the time. And because of that, actually, we were approached by Real Networks who were thinking about porting their Helix player to the laptop, which didn't currently have a media player. And so they met with our student developers and were talking about, you know, making some small donation to the lab to help us get some students to work on that project of porting Helix over to the OLPC. And kind of the more they talked with our students, the more they were impressed and the bigger the number got. And before we knew it, they were making a gift of $500,000 just to help support us in getting the Helix player ported over to the OLPC. So that was great. All of our students got involved in doing that. It was a lot of fun.
That's great.
So besides being a hosting service, as you were saying at the beginning of the show, you're also providing people who are willing to produce work in the open source arena. What kinds of other projects have you worked on in that way?
Well, OLPC is probably the one we're most well known for. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Bouncer previously, so that's the kind of download mirror selection tool. We helped write that for OpenOffice and for Mozilla. At the time, Mozilla was hosting all their servers here. They've since moved them back down to Silicon Valley. So those are a couple of them. One big project we have going on right now is called the Oregon Virtual School District. And what that is actually a K-12 learning platform that we're providing to all the schools here in Oregon. And so that's actually funded ODE, the Oregon Department of Education, has received grant money to provide this to the schools. And so we're doing all the hosting and development and actually building this platform on top of Drupal as a CMS and Moodle as a learning management system, so that basically any teacher at a public school in Oregon can just request a site for their course, and they can even pre-populate it with some content that, that we have.
That's great.
And it's been really great. There's about 19,000 users on it currently. And, you know, we use Drupal if the school or a school district wants to host their website with us. They can have a Drupal site there for free. So it's really been a cool project.
And Moodle is the classroom software, the open source classroom software, right?
Yeah, so Moodle lets you... It is like courseware, so you can define a course and define homework assignments and have forums and things where the students can interact. And it's pretty
it's
neat.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
It's stunning. Yeah.
We have Moodle on our list of people to talk to. That's what I was just wondering.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But now that's just for Oregon schools, though. That's not universal.
We're providing the service for Oregon schools there's not a lot of coding involved in this project. It's more hosting and kind of making things work. But there's definitely been some patches to Moodle and Drupal, which our developer, Greg Lanche, has been working with those communities as he needs to push things back. We're definitely all about sharing any other work we do. So that's a big deal to
us.
That's
really great.
So what is GOSCON?
Sure. So I mentioned it quickly at the beginning of the show, but GOSCON is our play on OSCON, but targeted at governments exclusively. So governments and nonprofits and state agencies that are interested in using open source or maybe don't even know what open source is, but would like to. It's kind of a way to educate them on here's what open source is, here's how you use it, here's some examples of how you could implement it. And last year was our fourth annual open source, government open source conference. And so kind of throughout the years, it's grown from kind of just showing people what open source is to actually giving them concrete examples of, hey, here's a group of people that are using open source in government and really making it work for them, or some kind of community collaboration model where all of these agencies all around are needing to implement very similar things. Why should you be going out and all paying separately to some company for software that doesn't really quite do what you want when you could actually group your resources and build something better?
Is this mostly for US organizations then?
Mostly for US, although last year we really spread out and went international. We actually, with the help of the World Bank, who was doing a live webcast, we got involved with people from Brazil, Senegal, Russia, Belgium, Sri Lanka, Spain, Japan. And we had a video conference going on for a whole day where we were all just, there was hundreds of people involved and all kind of sharing their local government experience of, here's what we're doing with open source and here's where we see ourselves going. And it was great to kind of just, just hear what all these different countries are doing and all the similarities there.
And I was curious about that. From that observation, can you tell me, is the U.S. ahead, behind, way behind in accepting open source in government and in NGOs?
I think we're ahead of some and way behind others. For example, people like Brazil have just really pushed for open source. And there's a big group inside the government that's working really hard to use open source wherever they can. I think... Now, with the new administration in the U.S., I think there's definitely going to be a change in policy coming soon. At least I hope so. We actually had two of our keynote speakers last year were Vivek Kundra and Anish Chopra, two of people that have been appointed to be the federal CIO and federal CTO, respectively. So that's really exciting. So we're helping, having those people that actually know about open source be inside the White House is going to be a big plus.
And you said this year's GOSCON's in D.C., right?
Yeah, and so we're hoping to get some momentum there and get some more federal government people involved in open source by taking the conference there to them, since we know it's kind of hard to travel in the current economy. So making it more of a local event in DC targeted towards federal government.
And when is that?
We're looking at October, November timeframe.
Okay. Very good. We'll have to have you back on talking specifically about that sometime. That'd be great.
Yeah. So if anyone's interested in that, the website is goscon.org. That's G-O-S-C-O-N.
So I think an important question that I suspect all of our listeners and viewers right now are going to want to know, and it's very, very important, but all of this work that you're doing sounds absolutely incredible and wonderful. How can people donate?
That is a wonderful question. You can actually donate if you're interested by just going straight to our website, which is osuosl.org. Mm. And there's a nice bright orange donate button there at the top. You know, anything helps, no amount's too small or too large. we definitely, like I said, we're totally run based off of these donations we receive. So that's what lets us host people, host all these projects is receiving donations from the communities and from these very generous companies like Google and IBM.
I'm just going to Twitter it right now.
I appreciate that.
Give money now.
Give money, please. Give money. Don't let the kernel go away.
Yeah. So if you want to see where your money is going, you can just go to our website and click on hosted communities. You're going to see a huge list of there's more than I can mention on the air because it would take up the rest of the show. But we're definitely supporting a huge amount of open source and just trying to do our part.
Just one odd question before we let you go, Jeff. What's the death ride?
Yeah, so you may see in my bio, I say that I'm planning to do the death ride next month. That's a road bike ride that's about 120-something miles long, and it starts just south of Lake Tahoe in California in a town called Markleyville. And you actually climb up five different mountain passes. So you actually do about 16,000 feet vertical climb. It's kind of a serious ride. That's why they call it the death ride. Hopefully I survive it. We'll see.
The fact that you use the word hopefully there is not inspiring.
That sounds really terrifying. I don't...
And I'll be doing it with my dad, who's doing it for, I think, the third or fourth time.
Wow, that's impressive.
So he's kind of my motivation. Hopefully I can keep up with him.
So he's a veteran at this. It should be renamed to Stay Alive.
Right. I think I can learn a thing or two. We'll see how it goes.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate your time, Jeff. And I'm glad you called Randall. He's probably going to be over in a minute to touch the server.
Yeah, we'd love to have any of you guys down whenever you can make it to Corvallis. Just give me a call and we'll get you guys a tour of the data center and a picture next to kernel.org.
I love it.
I'll get some B-roll. We can roll in next week, Leo.
Good. Thank you, Jeff. Great. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Leo.
Take care. Jeff Sheltren of Oregon State University. Are they the Ducks? Is that the Ducks?
It's Beavers.
Beavers.
Ducks are University of Oregon.
Right. Always confuse my Beavers and my Ducks.
Yeah. There it is. I was just waiting for it.
Well, we've got our Ducks in a row, and that's the main thing.
And Beavers both. That's really good. Yeah, Jeff emailed me a couple months ago. This is a great when guests do this with me. He just said, "Oh, we have something coming up. You really should talk to us." And we're just down the street. And I went, "Oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea." So, and
I'm
they
to remember
just
the names weren't of the big the old in the old days. They had a couple of big servers that served a lot of these software projects. And I just can't remember, you know, the kind of the main sites. But I guess he's taken over for a lot of them.
Used to be. I always remember it was SunSite.
SunSite. There you go.
Yeah.
Sun used to do that.
Brings back memories.
Everything came from SunSite.
Yeah.
And it's really great that when you know, because it's like you said, when you outgrow SourceForge and places like that, where they provide so much structure for you that unless you fit within their structure, it's kind of hard to do anything else. And to be able to have like your own box or your own virtual box and be able to do what you need to with it. Definitely useful for these sites. And the list of clients there is impressive. The list of host projects is very impressive.
I had no idea they were as diverse as they are.
It's pretty amazing. Just a great service these guys are providing. And, you know, I've got to say hometown or home state pride. I'm really happy that the Oregon's that committed to open source, doing this really cool stuff like that. Speaking of guests that write me and then get on the show, we have a bunch of really cool guests coming up. But first, I have to say that next week, you won't be hearing my dulcet tones. I am so sorry to say I'm actually going to be on site with a client. But, Jono, I understand you are stepping up to the plate and interviewing some... Can you say who it is?
Not yet. It's going to be a mystery guest.
A mystery guest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But wonderful and mysterious, whose mysteries exceeded only by their wonder, right? Or something like that, right?
I couldn't have put it any better. Maybe because I don't know words that long. But yeah, that's pretty much exactly it.
Well, now the pressure's on. You got to come up with somebody
wonderful. Wonderful and mysterious, right? But the following week, just added to our schedule. Very happy to have these guys coming on. And actually, once I tweeted this, everybody was just in a Twitter about this. We've got Ted Gould and John Cruz of the Inkscape Project. Inkscape is a vector-based editor. It's being used in it's equivalent of like Adobe Illustrator for drawing vector graphics. But it's very mature. If you think of the GIMP as Photoshop, this is like Illustrator. This is the vector drawing thing. And very, very cool stuff. They're going to be on the show in a couple of weeks. Looking forward to that. And I think the show we're going to run after that in the sequence is Jono and I last week taped a show about Jaunty Jackalope. So we'll be running that. And that's actually one of the weeks that Leo's going to be gone in China. So we'll be hooking up. So no interruption in shows. We're just going to keep right on with Floss Weekly as if Leo is not leaving. So very good at doing that.
That's pretty much how the show is anyway. Just pretend I'm sitting there pushing the buttons.
Hey, you're pushing all the buttons that we need. Yeah, you got to come up with your jokes occasionally. That's been very cool. If you want to find out what's coming up in the future, you should go to the website that's linked from twit.tv/floss. You can email me to request future shows at floss@twit.tv, but please look at the upcoming list of guests already to make sure I don't already have that on the list. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlin, MERLYN, and I will be live streaming from time to time my karaoke sessions. So, in fact, I'm doing that tonight after this taping. Watch for Twitter, and you can find out when I'm actually going to be on. Also, just one last plug for me, and then we'll let Jono do a few plugs of his own. I have been finalizing the details for it's going to be a huge party. Since I'm now on the Linux Fund board, linuxfund.org, we're throwing this giant party at OSCON to celebrate 10 years of giving away almost $500,000 to valid and valuable open source projects. So we're celebrating by throwing a big party. And we've got some great surprises. Can't talk about it just yet because we're just dotting the I's and crossing the T's on the contracts and getting it all in place. But I tell you, stop by. It's going to be the kick-ass party for OSCON this year on Wednesday night, the 22nd.
Can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right, guys, thank you for being here. We appreciate your time. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.